So today we're looking at Dhammapada verse 285, which reads as follows. Uchinda sineham matano kumudang saradikangwa panina santi magameva bruhaya nibbanang sugatena desitang. Which means, cut off the love of self, just as one would a lotus stalk in the autumn, in the fall, with one's hand. Cultivate the path of peace, Nibbana, taught by the Sugata. This verse was taught in response or in regards to a specific monk who had ordained at a young age from a family of goldsmiths. So a wealthy young man who became inspired by the Buddha's teaching and gave up his wealth and his station, his family, gave up the world in order to apply himself to the cultivation of such worthy teachings as the Buddha taught. He became a student of Sariputta, Sariputta being one of the Buddha's chief disciples, the wisest of all of the Buddha's disciples. And he lived with Sariputta for some time. And Sariputta thought to himself that young men in general are inclined towards lust and desire for towards the physical form. So perhaps I should teach him to apply himself to the parts of the body. It's called the non-beautiful nature of the body, the meditation on the non-beautiful, because objectively the body is not beautiful. It's full of all sorts of things that taken individually are not attractive to anybody, but when put together give the illusion of beauty. So by taking them apart, it's a powerful practice to weaken and free one from the binds of lust and desire towards the body. So it can be a good entry point to the cultivation of concentration and the cultivation of tranquility, which can then be used as a means of practicing vipassana, or mindfulness. But this young man practiced for a month and got nowhere with the practice, was unable to even focus his mind, had no capacity to connect. It just didn't resonate with him. He couldn't connect with the instruction, the technique at all. So the technique would be to sit and recite, much in the same way that we recite, for example, rising, falling, or pain. You instead recite the names of the parts of the body. In the same way as we do, it focuses your attention, but it focuses it in a different way. It focuses it on concepts. The hair on the head, the hair on the body, not the experiences of seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling and thinking, but rather the idea of the hair and so on. It's a means of making clear to you the reality of the physical body as something that is not beautiful. So when you look at the hair on the head, well, over time you start to realize the hair on the head is kind of greasy and smelly and it grows like rice in the scalp and so on. But it didn't resonate with this man at all. Didn't help him at all. And this is peculiar because this sort of meditation is considered to be one of the general meditations that everyone, all Buddhists, should take up from time to time, but is really only incredibly useful for those who have strong lust and attachment towards the body. So for some reason, this young man didn't take to the practice at all. Practiced for a month, came back to Sariputta and told his teacher that he wasn't getting anywhere with it. So Sariputta said, well, you have to apply yourself and you can't expect results right away. And he explained it in detail and checked and made to make sure that he was doing everything correctly. And he said, well, apply yourself once more. Sometimes it's just takes time. So for another month, this monk went off and practiced on his own. Came back after a month and said the same thing. He still wasn't getting anywhere at all. The practice, it just didn't resonate with him. It didn't. He couldn't find any good results at all. So Sariputta checked and tried his best to figure out what was going wrong. He offered him similes and explanations. Why is this practice useful? Tried to figure out what he had been negligent in omitting from his instruction, and he basically gave him a very well-rounded explanation of this very same practice that was kind of not working for him. So he practiced it for another month with all this new inspiring instruction, really appreciating the teaching of his teacher and having confidence in the teacher's wisdom, and so was wholeheartedly ready to apply himself. Practiced for another month and again got nowhere with it. So at this point, Sariputta kind of realized something. There was a deeper problem, and thought to himself, well, surely if there was some benefit to be had here, that this application, this wholehearted, dedicated application from this monk would have reached some sort of benefit from this practice. There must be something deeper going on. Probably the best bet is to take him to the Buddha and see if the Buddha can help him in some way. So he went with the monk to the Buddha and told the Buddha about the issue. He said, I can't figure out what is the right meditation, right way to teach him meditation. It's not working. Venerable Sir, could you please instruct him in the practice of the Buddha's teaching? So the Buddha said to Sariputta, he said, yes, well, the problem, the root problem is that only Buddha is able to know for sure what is the right meditation. It's excusable because, not being a Buddha yourself, you don't have this depth of wisdom to be able to perceive the exact proper course to apply to any given student. And so he looked at this man and he considered this young monk, and he reflected and thought and realized to himself that this man, or this monk, had not only been a part of a goldsmith family in this life, but for lifetime after lifetime, he had only ever been born in this very same family of goldsmiths, and had spent every life, lifetime after lifetime, working with gold, making gold statues, gold rings, gold jewelry, gold this and gold that, constantly focused and focusing his attention on the work of gold. And so it was really difficult to find anything that resonated with him apart from working with gold, because of how deeply ingrained it was in his psyche and how single-minded had been his focus lifetime after lifetime. So he had some kind of attachment to gold that could be used for a beneficial purpose. And so the Buddha manifested an image of a golden lotus, a red gold lotus. So gold sometimes has a reddish color. And he gave him this lotus made of red gold. This is the story. I don't know. This is what the story says. And he said, take this golden lotus and go down to the pond and meditate on it. And when you meditate on it, say to yourself, red, red, lohita, lohita, lohitang, lohitang. No, lohitakang, 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 which means red, red. So again, this practice of repeating a mantra to focus your attention on something, in this case, to focus your attention on red, which is a very, very common basic Buddhist practice for the cultivation of tranquility. So the monk took the lotus and went down to the river and the pond and stuck it in the sand, with the stalk facing up and this beautiful blooming flower. And he sat there and he looked at it and he just said to himself, red, red, red. And it resonated immediately with him. So it wasn't able to cure him of any kind of attachment that he might have had, but it was able to suppress the immediate hindrances. So the deeper attachments, maybe not, but it was suitable from the very beginning, from the very instant that he began to look at it, in focusing his attention. He was easily able to appreciate the redness of the gold because of his past. So as he said to himself, red, red, eventually everything faded away. Even the lotus itself faded away, and all that was left was the color red, and he was able to absorb himself, to get into a sort of a deep absorbed state of calm and tranquility that we call jhana. Jhana means meditation, but this jhana is an absorbed state of meditation where the mind is fixed and focused only on a single concept, in this case focused on the color red. And so as he said to himself, red, red, entered into this state of tranquility, and was able to cultivate it so deeply that he went through the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana, the fifth jhana, all the way up to the highest, most subtle state, where all that really existed for him was red, without any distraction, without any attachment or aversion, any worry or doubt, any fatigue or drowsiness. Without even any joy or happiness, just a very subtle, tranquil state of calm that was even more peaceful than a happy feeling. So this state of pure and subtle calmness. A really, really impressive achievement, for sure. And at this point, he stayed in that state and practiced continuously, and was able to stay in this very stable, satisfying, and comfortable state, which again, a great accomplishment. But the Buddha considered again and thought to himself, what's going on with this monk, and realized that he had accomplished something. Through his practice of focusing on this lotus, he had tranquilized his mind and entered into the various states of jhana. But the Buddha then reflected to himself, is he going to be able to go further? Because you see, the cultivation of samatha jhana is not the goal, and it's not sustainable. It's not a viable solution to the problem of suffering. Why? Because it's impermanent. It will never last forever, and furthermore, it requires work, which isn't in and of itself a bad thing, but the point is, you can never stop working. In order to attain jhana, you have to keep up your effort, your endeavor to focus your attention on a single object. And so that's not a real problem, but it's something that can never be let up, because as soon as you stop or are interrupted or have some calamity or old age, sickness and death, which are all inevitable, you will lose the ability to focus and suffer disturbance and distraction, and eventually maybe even be sent on another path. It isn't a solution to samsara, because eventually you give it up, lifetime after lifetime, eventually you veer away and inevitably are taken on another course, and can even still be reborn in the lower realms as an animal or a ghost or even in hell. Not related to the practice of jhana, but because eventually it doesn't keep you under its power. It doesn't protect you, not in the way that enlightenment or nibbana or the practice of vipassana and mindfulness does. So the Buddha considered to himself, this monk was actually stuck. He had attained a good thing in a worldly sense and as a sort of preparatory practice, but he was completely unable to go further because there was still very much attachment involved with this practice. Obviously, he was very much fixated on the color of the gold and the nature of the gold and so on. He wasn't at all capable of seeing through that. He would never be able to see the three characteristics, is the point. So the Buddha said, well, I better help him again. And so he made this determination that changed the lotus. So he had this beautiful, blooming red lotus, red gold lotus. And he made a determination for it to wither. And immediately it began to crumble and blacken, like a rotten lotus. This is like if you were to crumple a lotus up in your hand, and it got all wrinkly and withered and wilting. which of course pulled the monk completely out of his trance and shook him up and made him ask himself, how is this possible? What's this reality that I'm experiencing now? What's going on? And realized him, impressed upon him the fact that even this gold, this long-lasting, seemingly stable and satisfying state is subject to loss. They're just the simple experience of being shaken out of the trance and the tranquility and being unable to find it again. Because once you lose the object and are confronted with something unappealing, something that your mind recoils from, you lose all capacity to attain the state. So even when he tried to close his eyes, he was still bombarded with these visions, this shocking vision of the wilted gold. Like, how could a golden lotus suddenly wilt like an ordinary lotus that had gotten old? And it intrigued him, and it opened his mind, broadened his perspective, which is, of course, the shift that we undergo when we make the change from the practice of samatha to the practice of vipassana. It's what differentiates the two, where you start to be a little more open-minded, a little bit less fixated on a single object, and more open to the changes and the underlying mechanisms behind things like a lotus. What's going on behind the scenes? Because even gold does eventually break apart and disintegrate. There's nothing in the universe that isn't subject to cessation. So based on this, he was forced to confront this chaos in his mind and the states that he had been suppressing, states of attachment and so on, and was forced to look a little bit deeper and to appreciate, well, what we call the three characteristics. So as a result, he could start to see that his mind, even though it seemed so stable and so satisfying and controllable, now he could see that that was a temporary experience, that it was impermanent, that it was unsatisfying, because it didn't make him happier. Now that he was unable to attain that state, he was back right at the very beginning where he first started, struggling and uncomfortable, stressed and unhappy, and he was unable to control it. So he began to see the three characteristics, and he was able to bring himself closer to actually truly letting go and truly becoming free. And so the Buddha saw that at this point his mind started to mature. He started to confront and face the true reality of the true nature of reality, not as being beautiful like a lotus, but being unbeautiful, unattractive, not worth clinging to. And started to realize that this idea of clinging even to things that seem stable, satisfying, controllable is untenable. It's not the way to find true freedom from suffering. There's no one thing that can truly make you happy. Happiness has to come from letting go, of course. And so this is the point where the Buddha began to see that he was changing. But another thing happened, and this is what relates to the verse. As he was contemplating this lotus that had withered, he looked out onto the pond and saw other lotuses that were still coming up beautiful and blooming and seemed very attractive and appealing. And he was comparing them and considering them, and then he saw these boys over at one side of the pond, and they had started cutting the lotuses and throwing them on the side of the pond. And he looked over at the ones that they had cut and saw that they had withered. And it all just started to connect with him, just the very simple nature of reality. Even these lotuses that were beautiful, once they're cut, once they die, they get old and they wither and they die. Everything. And if these things, if this can happen to gold, if this can happen to lotuses, of course, this is my nature as well. This is what's happening in my mind. In my own mind, the chaos, in my own body, the disturbance, changing from moment to moment. This is the nature of reality. There's really nothing, there's no refuge. There's nothing I can hold on to. So very quickly, he started to go through the stages of knowledge that we guide meditators through in our courses. And then the Buddha came to him again. Came to him as he would do in a vision and recited this verse to him, taught him this, gave him this instruction to give up love of self. So this is the story and this is the verse. The lessons from the story, the first thing we learn from this story, of course, is how great the Buddha is. So like many of the stories in the Dhammapada, they remind us of the greatness of the Buddha in terms of his own attainments and his own wisdom and his ability to teach others, his ability to guide others. So it gives us a reminder of the greatness of the teaching. Obviously, we are the unfortunate reality of not having the benefit of learning directly from the Buddha. So never mind Sariputta, we don't have any connection to these great teachers, the Buddha, Sariputta. But what we do have is the Dhamma. So ultimately what we do have is all of these stories, and not just the stories, of course, the more importantly, the actual teachings, the teachings on mindfulness, the teachings on the practice of samatha, the practice of vipassana, the teachings on the cultivation of ethics and concentration and wisdom. We have 45 years of teaching that the Buddha left with us in order to provide us with a framework, an outline for how to approach the practice of understanding reality and letting go of attachment and becoming free from suffering. But ultimately we appreciate this, we appreciate the greatness of the Buddha, but acknowledge that we don't have this connection with the Buddha, and have to appreciate that our practice is never going to be this simple lock and key path where we find the right key and it unlocks the door and we become enlightened. As we can see from many of these stories, the second lesson from the story is the differentiation of individuals. So not everyone needs the same instruction, and not everyone is going to have the same sort of practice. For some people, practice is going to be easy and quick. For others, it's going to be slow and difficult. And as we get on and on, further and further away from the time of the Buddha, of course, the general trend is for the practice for individuals to become more difficult and slower. But even putting that aside, it's also not simply a straight path, because everyone has different obstacles, different challenges, different focuses, different things they need to focus on. It's a big reason why we tend to offer the practice of mindfulness consistently and exclusively, not paying great attention to all of these many other alternative practices or specific practices that are specific to certain individuals. Like, I could teach you how to focus on the red color. You could practice mindfulness of red, you know, the red kasina, and say to yourself, lohita, but it might be good for you and it might not be good for you. There's no one on earth who's in the position to be able to verify whether that is a good practice for you that is going to ultimately lead you to enlightenment. And so out of caution, we offer the core teachings and teach the existence of other teachings and offer some of them as supplements. Like, for example, mindfulness of the unbeautiful parts of the body is something that is still encouraged, that you can practice day to day. There's another one is metta, so many people find helpful the practice from time to time of expressing kindness or love, and we incorporate that in some ways into our practice as well, and so on. Mindfulness of the Buddha is another one. Being mindful of the Buddha is valuable to create inspiration, encouragement, help you when you're flagging, when you're floundering or unsure of yourself, and give you the motivation to continue. And mindfulness of death. Mindfulness of death can be useful to remind you of the limited time that we have on this earth to cultivate good things. That if we waste our time, we'll just waste this precious opportunity that we have to be born a human being, to meet with the Buddha Sasana, and so on. So these sorts of meditations are valuable, but again, as we can see from the story, valuable only to certain people. And so because of our acknowledgement that the nature or the path of individuals is not sure, as when we approach the teaching, we have to understand that It may not be an easy path, and it may not be something that we connect with and quite quickly and easily attain enlightenment, but there's really no helping that, and it's not something we should fret or concern ourselves with. We appreciate the benefits of the practice, and we see the benefits, and even whether it be slow or fast, we apply ourselves, knowing that it might be a long and winding road, you know, that we have to follow. Yeah, just generally applying ourselves as best we can, and realizing that we may meet with various obstacles, but focusing our attention on the core, because of our inability to really and truly know for sure which practices are going to be a benefit. The problem with things like samatha practice in general is that they are focused on concepts. And those concepts are—they're not grounded in reality. So the concept of red, the idea of red, has nothing to do with your moments of experience. When you experience red, it's just seeing. But if you focus on the idea of red, it's really kind of dissociated from reality. And as a result, it can lead you into other concepts. A person focusing on red could have some strange vision of something red, like blood, for example. The word lohitaka actually means that which is of blood, the color of blood. So maybe someone, based on their past karma, might go in a bad direction with that because of all the various trauma that might be associated with blood. For example, someone who practices mindfulness of the unbeautiful parts of the body might become depressed if they're not in the right mind state. There were cases of this in the Buddha's time where it really had a detrimental effect on a person's mental well-being. So the problem with samatha practice, because it's conceptual in nature, it connects with the mind and it can lead you on a tangent away from reality. The greatness of mindfulness, though it might be uncomfortable and not nearly as pleasant as that jhana process sounds like, is that it's rooted in reality. You can never really go wrong. Why the Buddha praised mindfulness and pushed for the practice of mindfulness as the core teaching is because it's rooted in reality. When instead of saying red, red, you would say seeing, seeing, or when you focus on experiences like the stomach rising or sitting or the pain or so on, you're grounded in reality. You can't go wrong in the same way. It can never lead you to some strange concept or trauma or so on. Any emotions that might come up as a result can as well be dealt with, as well be faced and focused on because of their nature as ultimate reality. So important to understand this distinction of practice, and really no matter what you practice, to take this as a lesson, an example of how someone can get stuck. This is a common experience with people who practice samatha practice. They become very calm and tranquil, and that's a great tool to bring your mind to be able to focus on reality. But it's quite common to not take the next step. And this is why the Buddha had to help this goldsmith monk showing him a vision. And the Buddha's done this in several occasions where he would show someone the opposite side of what they were attracted to help them appreciate the potential for loss, the potential for change, and the trauma and stress that comes when you lose the things that you're attached to, when you lose the things you depend upon for peace and happiness and so on. The third lesson is that was the third lesson. So the first lesson is the greatness of the Buddha. We appreciate the greatness of the Buddha and the greatness of the Dhamma. And so while it might make us feel lose heart or lose hope because we don't have this connection with the Buddha directly and we don't have the capacity to get the best teaching that might possibly exist, on the other hand, we have his teachings. So we appreciate that we have this opportunity that many people in the world don't have, to meet with the Buddha's teaching. The second lesson is differentiation of individuals. So appreciating that our practice might be specific to us, and to know that we might have specific problems, and that shouldn't dissuade us, shouldn't discourage us. Sometimes we might need to apply ourselves differently from others. The third lesson is the differentiation of meditation topics, which I've already dealt with as well. So the difference between samatha practice and the difference between samatha practice and vipassana practice. The practice of samatha is great as a beginning tool, but ultimately has its pitfalls and perils and can lead to stagnation at the very least and potentially lead to danger and trauma unwholesomeness if given to the wrong person. Whereas vipassana, though uncomfortable and unpleasant in some cases, is honest and sincere and connected with reality, and so ultimately safer and more powerful and necessary. You can't just practice samatha to attain enlightenment. Whether someone practices it first or not, ultimately they have to undertake the practice of mindfulness, satipatthana, vipassana, in order to connect with reality and understand it and let go of the attachments that we have to it and to anything. As for the verse is not connected with this the story so much, because by the time the Buddha teaches the verse, this monk is in a different frame of mind. So the connection here is, once one has seen the three characteristics, what is the way forward? And the Buddha makes clear this idea of love of self as being core in leading to, or core in terms of what we have to confront in order to attain the goal of freedom from suffering. Well, it's an interesting concept. It's an interesting idea, because we're often told of the importance in worldly society. We're taught about the importance of loving yourself, right? We see loving ourselves as being a way to counter low self-esteem. When a person hates themselves or is overly critical of themselves, often we feel bad about ourselves. Maybe we think we're ugly physical, or maybe we think we're stupid or unintelligent, unsuccessful, unpopular, have no friends, have no loved ones, have no wealth or possessions, have no station, all the things we don't have. And so we're always taught to, or we're often taught to, love yourself. So here the Buddha comes and he says, cut off love of self. And the truth is that even when one has low self-esteem, it is still because of love of self. Because it's not love of oneself, it's not love of a particular self, love of the self that you have. It's this attachment or partiality or liking of some kind of self. If you hate yourself, it's only ever because you wish you were some other way. If you didn't care about how you were, you wouldn't hate yourself. If you didn't have any desire for yourself to be this way or that way, if ugliness didn't bother you, ugliness wouldn't bother you if you didn't have this attachment to beauty. Wishing you were this way, wishing you were that way. If you wish that you were more intelligent, wish that you were more wealthy, you have attachment to that self, the self that you wish you were. And so it doesn't matter whether you have low self-esteem or high self-esteem. If you're proud of yourself, if you're conceited about yourself, if you are confident about yourself, if you like the way you look, like the way your mind works, like your ability, like your station in life, or not. The problem isn't being beautiful or rich or smart or powerful or ugly or poor or unintelligent or unloved, alone. The problem is your attachment to it. And so this is a very deep teaching, this teaching of non-self that often leads people, gives people trouble when they try to understand the Buddha's teaching. We try to understand it intellectually and we philosophize, but this isn't a philosophical teaching. This is why the Buddha phrases it this way. He doesn't say, let go of self or try to see non-self. He said, give up love of self, attachment to self, because this is what the three characteristics are all about. They're not intellectual, they're not philosophical. They're the reason why you shouldn't cling to things. You shouldn't attach or hold on to anything, because nothing in the world is stable, satisfying, or controllable. The problem is that we look at things, we conceive of things, and we think that will be stable. If I can attain that, or if I can keep this, this is stable. Because it's stable, it's satisfying. We think this will satisfy me. If I can get this or if I can keep this, as long as I have this, I will be satisfied. I will be happy. And we think we can control. We try to control, or we do spend our time controlling, keeping things under control, keeping our mind under control, keeping our body, keeping our weight under control, keeping our family, our partner, keeping our job, keeping our finances, our health under control, all of the things that we try to keep under control. Control, control, control. Based on our love of self, our attachment, our desire to maintain the self or to attain some self. When we begin to practice mindfulness, we begin to see the flaw in this approach towards life and reality in general, because reality isn't amenable to that. Reality is unstable, changing constantly. Experiences are unsatisfying. There's nothing that you can experience and say, hey, that is my true happiness, and that's what's going to make me happy forever. Or control, or self, seeing that experiences are momentary. And this idea of self is just a concept. And the idea of control is just an illusion. We see that our own body we can't control, our even mind, our own mind we can't even control. The body, the mind, let alone all the external realities, other people, the weather, the climate, our environment, our health and happiness are all unpredictable and uncontrollable. As we start to change our attitude towards things, and this is the path that the Buddha enjoined, focusing on, in the case of this monk, our love of self, which is a great way to sum up the core of the Buddha's teaching, or the core of the problem that the Buddha's teaching is designed to address. To let go of love of self, to let go of any kind of desire to be a certain way or to stay a certain way. The second part of the verse is the simile. You know, the Buddha says, cut it off. And then the second part he says, like one would cut off a lotus stalk. So it's useful for this monk because he's sitting looking at lotuses. But it's also, there's a key point here that's valuable for all of us. And this is in the fall, the Buddha says. He says, cut it off like you would a lotus in the fall, in the harvest season. And it's a simple, I mean, I don't want to read too much into it, but it's important. And the importance is that there has to be a maturity of the situation before you can accomplish this goal. And this relates to the idea of intellectualizing self and the three characteristics in general, or trying to gain some results in the Buddha's teaching by just immediately profiting from knowledge. So you learn about the three characteristics, you wrestle with them, and you don't get anywhere. Or you practice samatha meditation and you don't get anywhere. In order to cut off defilements, in order to cut off one's attachment and aversion and delusion in relation to self, in relation to permanence, in relation to pleasure, one needs a level of maturity. So it comes through the progress on the path. And this isn't something that you can force. It's not something we can put a date on. Again, for each individual, it's going to be different. It's going to be specific to them. But through the practice of maturity, the cutting off doesn't come as long as the situation isn't mature. Like a lotus, if you try to cut it off when it's still green, I guess it probably doesn't break in the same way as it would in the fall. I think lotuses, once they're mature, then they just snap off. But when they're young, they don't snap in the same way. And so this coming to terms with the nature of reality and freeing ourselves from attachment to self or attachment to anything comes through the cultivation of the Buddha's teaching, and comes at the end of the Buddha's teaching, once you've reached maturity. And so not something we should fuss about or focus on in the beginning. We tell meditators not to focus too much on the three characteristics as a question of whether you're seeing them or how to see them or how you should go about seeing them. You focus on the practice of mindfulness, and you can see from the very beginning the three characteristics start to arise, but they come on their own as a result of the maturation of mindfulness. They come moment after moment, and the cutting off comes through seeing the three characteristics so frequently and so extensively that finally there is a maturity and there's this breaking off. And it really is an apt simile, because at that point the mind has changed, this stickiness that keeps us clinging and seeking out objects to possess and to be. This is me, this is mine, and so on. Really evaporates, like the stickiness of the lotus, and there's a drying up of all of this well of greed and anger and delusion. And with the drying up, there is the maturity, and then the mind comes to a point where it's able to make the break, which happens irrevocably. It happens without being able to go back. Like when you cut off the lotus stalk, you can't put it back together and hope that the lotus grows again. And the third part of the verse is a reminder of why it's important to let go of love of self, and that is because this is the Santi Magga taught by the Buddha, the path of peace. Because ultimately, again, our goal isn't just to understand the three characteristics or even just to let go of self. Why is that important? It's important because this is the cause of all of our stress, all of our disturbance. It's what keeps us from finding peace. You think of all the worldly ways in which self gets in the way of peace and happiness and freedom from suffering. When we have ego, conceit, when people are possessive, how much of the world's problems are just because of us hoarding and greeding for the things that we want, part of the people who can get what they want, keeping it from the people who can't get what they want, stealing from others, manipulating others, even just destroying the environment, destroying the world around us through our short-sighted need to be satisfied, to be satiated again and again in a way that can never possibly hope to satisfy us, in a never-ending search for happiness. This selfness, selfishness, trying to hold on to the things that we want, and holding on to our self, holding on to the things that we identify with or cling to as me and mine. This is what keeps us from finding peace, and that true peace doesn't come from love of self, doesn't come from loving yourself.